just really happy to have Catherine and Sadiq and their family. They came up last week and they drove from Oklahoma.
Oh my God.
We made some stops, Atlanta and Baltimore, and then up. And they were here in time for last week's reading with Miriam Nichols, and that was wonderful too. And they've been here the whole week, and we've been exploring. And Sadiq has had a two-day dance and drum workshop, African dance and drum workshop, in collaboration with Sarah Slifer, and that happened the last couple days. And so it's been a lot happening, you know, and made a lot of connections and friends and new ideas just developing. So anyways, a couple comments about Catherine. This is why she's special to me anyways, is the first impression I got from her. I invited her up to Gloucester in 1995. She came up and I had arranged with my brother-in-law to give her a ride in a fishing boat, my brother-in-law's fishing boat, so we got on. So I could show her Gloucester, you know. Halfway through the trip, I realized, you know, she was piloting the boat. So she was looking for Gloucester in her own way. She was charting her own course, not just accepting what I had to show her, you know. So it's not that type of schooling that she was looking for. That always stuck in my mind. And then the other thing, when I heard that Henry would, you know, invited me to make the opening sort of comments, so this morning I wrote down a little poem. I keep everything in my wallet, no matter what size it is. So, and everything fits in there somehow. And a lot of this has to do with impressions that I have of Catherine. So, this is called Dis Poem, D-I-S, and this is credited to Muta Baruka. I don't know if people know Muta Baruka. He's a Jamaican dub poet, a friend of Catherine's, somebody that I had followed since I was a kid, I guess, I don't know, in the 70s, and I was lucky enough to actually meet him through Catherine. So I don't know how many different connections you have, but that was a lucky one that I lucked out on. So Dis Poem, and this is in honor of Fritz and Faye John, Catherine's parents, and Mary Baraka, Audre Lorde, Zora Neale Hurston, and others. So shall it be, Catherine John Kamara. God, back in 1967, makes this sister outsider come this side of heaven. You can't hide her. See, Sun Ra said, space is the place. Yes, it's the planet of life. She jumps off from Jamaica. Jamaica? Oh yeah. So, Dis Poem. God takes him pen. I'm trying to use a little mood. I'm trying to channel Muta Baruka a little bit. God takes him pen, using colors again and again. Colors of heaven, him sparks flash up. Count now how many times, daughter, sister, wife, friend, all mash up. More to come, more formations, and then change. And so, live from the Apollo, James Brown screams, I've lost someone. And then I add, because this is how I always hear the song, 10,000 people out of my past. But then morning, oh yeah, beautiful, like this poem we looking at. It's like some things you know, okay, but some things you got to know. Oh yeah. God, Jamaican woman, you say? God, I ask you, is it insight, delight, or just making it right? Oh, I see. And a bit of stand up and fight? All right. Then let us pray. Ashe, ashe.
Thank you, John. That's the most unique welcome I've ever had. I appreciate it. So... Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Do I need
this doesn't
the mic?
This doesn't
add. It doesn't add volume. Okay, so I'll just speak up. I had the opportunity to come last week when Miriam Nichols was here, and I afterwards looked at the introduction to her book, which was her book, Radical Affectations, Essays on the Poetics of the Outside. And one of the things that she spoke about in her book, in the introduction, was what she called allowings, right? And she used that language to talk about the poetry that she centers in her book. So I use that merely as a jump-off point to say that I'm hoping to, for those people who are thinking about things in the types of ways that she does, this is another type of allowing, right, that I'm going to sort of enter in. But I want to make a disclaimer, which I don't think I have to, but I will, which is that I am by no stretch of the imagination an expert on the work of Amiri Baraka. But I feel as if I've been definitely influenced by some of his work, and of late, profoundly influenced by his essay, The Changing Same, written during what people call his Black Nationalist period in 1966 and mostly focused on music. So what I wanted to do really today was to share with you all some of my thoughts about the essay, but I'm really putting it within a broader context, to some extent a context of the things that I'm interested in, and to some extent the context of my own life, personally, intellectually, right, academically. And I hope that we will then be able to have somewhat of a conversation, after I'm done. So I wanted to start in a unique place and tell you a little bit about myself and where I'm coming from. Part of it is that, is that someone knocking? No. Oh, sorry. No? Okay. All right. Okay. I am the great, is it great? Let me see. One great? Great, great granddaughter of a man named Charles Needham Grant, who was an enslaved African on a plantation in Jamaica, and who actually was granted his freedom during the period when Jamaica went through the emancipation phase in the late 1830s, 1838. And he married a woman named Amelia Byfield, and he and Amelia had, I believe, 12 children. His youngest child's name was Gracie McLeod, and she is my great-grandmother, right? She was quite young. She was much, how do I say this? Because she was his youngest child, that makes the lineage and the relationship that I have to that history closer than it would be, right? Because to think that my great-great-grandparent was enslaved seems kind of close, right? Gracie McLeod also had 12 children with her husband, Tom, who was a second-generation carpenter-builder, right, in the Jamaican context. And so, what you found was that a lot of people from that generation, some of whom were direct descendants of enslaved Africans, had a set of skills that got passed down in a systematic way, right, to some of their forebears. So two generations of carpenter builders, Tom McLeod. And then Gracie's daughter, Julia, is my grandmother on my mother's side, my mother's mother, right? My mother was one of 11 children. She was the ninth child. And her generation in Jamaica, she came of age during the independence era. And she was very, very bright, very smart academically, and was part of that first generation in her family that went on for an advanced degree, right? She ended up getting a master's in botany from McGill University in Canada. And for most of her life, she was a science teacher, right? My father came from a small island in the Eastern Caribbean called St. Vincent. And he was raised by his grandparents, Urias and Amelia Charles, whose parents came out of slavery. And he decided to go into the ministry and went to Jamaica, right, which is where the main seminary at that time in the Caribbean for that type of study was. And in Jamaica, he met my mother. And he eventually went and studied at the University of Pittsburgh and did a degree in divinity, got a master's in divinity, and then went to the University of Birmingham and did a degree in sacred theology of some sort. But my parents, so we're very rooted in a kind of Methodism, right? But on the other hand, they were both, how shall I say, my mother was really scientific and my father was very much in love with the history and the politics of the time period that he grew up in. And I think that they both sort of laid a kind of, how shall I say, a questioning foundation for me, right? I migrated to the U.S. in 1981 from Jamaica. I was 14, and my younger sister, I have one younger sister, she was 8 at the time. And my father became somewhat disenchanted with the Caribbean Methodist situation and for various reasons decided that he wanted to come to the States and was able to come. And we moved to Medford, Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. So I went to Medford High. Finished high school. I was already in high school.
You and Joe Torre were comparing notes about Medford
High. Oh, yes.
Yes. Joe Torre went to Medford
High. Yes. Yes. I went to Medford High, and then I went to Boston College and worked in Boston for a while until I decided that I wanted to go on to graduate school. So why am I starting here? I'm starting here because some of the things that I want to talk about as I get more deeply into the subject, I wanted to situate it within the context of who I am and make it clear that this type of work for me is, on the one hand, it's intellectual, on the other hand, it's personal, it's collective, you know, it's communal, right? And, you know, and so for me, it's important to remind myself about that. So I jump forward. In grad school, I went to grad school, I went to the University of California, Santa Cruz, and I learned how to take things apart, right, intellectually. And at some point, I realized that I could not put them back together. And I fell into a brief but deep depression. And when I emerged from the depression, I realized that this inability to put things back together was a particular characteristic of Western cultural tradition. At least that's how I saw it. And Audre Lorde's poetry and Alice Walker's essays pulled me out of the depression, and I decided to sort of spiritually return to the things that I knew, right? Because there was a way in which in grad school, I went to grad school thinking, I want to learn more about Caribbean literature, I want to learn more about the world that I came from and see how it fits into this larger thing. And then I got there and it was in the height of post-structuralist theoretical approaches and, you were led to believe or made to feel that what you knew was somehow inadequate and what you needed to learn was all this other stuff, right? So anyway, I've written one book. It's called Clear Word and Third Sight, Folk Groundings and Diasporic Consciousness in African Caribbean Writing. It was a revision of my dissertation. And essentially, I became interested in what I would call a tradition of resilience. I focused on Afro-Caribbean and African-American 20th century literature and culture, but I was really interested in the African aspect of that background, because I began to wonder how it was possible, right, for people who had been the descendants of enslaved Africans, who had moved, been transported through the transatlantic slave trade, and who had suffered a lot of dehumanization, degradation, brutality, and such, you know, considered property in a lot of different places, and, you know, the societies that they found themselves in, you know, were not just not concerned with their survival, but saw them simply as a means to an end. And so I wondered, how is it possible for a people to come, be spread out from wherever they were taken to wherever they ended up, and to survive that kind of brutality, right? Have children, make music, recreate language patterns, develop innovative food culture, sports, dance, you know, have a sort of unique approach to religiosity and, you know, significantly contribute in a way to the development of Western civilization after such trauma. I wanted to know how that was possible, right? And so my research is an enduring attempt to find some answers to those types of questions, right? One of the terms that I use in the title of my book, which to some extent is in a way my own, is diasporic consciousness. It was a development of an idea from a scholar named Veve Clark, who wrote an essay that deeply influenced me called Diaspora Literacy and Morass of Consciousness. And so the idea of diasporic consciousness, first of all, the diaspora that I was referring to was the African diaspora, those people who were the descendants of formerly enslaved Africans who were spread out throughout the Americas, right? The U.S., the Caribbean, Brazil, you know, even though my focus is primarily on the English-speaking Caribbean, a little bit of the French, and the U.S. ultimately. I broadened my interest in that area. But I was interested in a collective sense of consciousness and whether it functioned consciously or subconsciously, right? I wasn't using Jung, but I was interested I felt as if this thing that I was calling diaspora consciousness was collective, was not always conscious, but had transmitted to the descendants of enslaved Africans the ability to survive extreme physical and psychological trauma. And in the book, what I did is I tried to look at where those repositories of resilience were, and I focused on the proverbs, the folk tales, the oral tradition, the extent to which it emerged as part of the oral literature, and then some writers borrowed from the oral literature that they were raised within, right, and translated it into some kind of written format. And so that was the sort of diasporic consciousness piece, which, you know, I sort of put my toe into an ocean that some people had started to explore in certain ways was unexplored, but there sort of feels like there's a lot to do and to say in that area. One of the things that I figured out when I wrote the book was that in the academy, when people use the word culture, they were usually talking about a category or a description of something that could be applied to a variety of things, right? It could be applied to something that was positive or negative. It could be a generic description. It could be a description of something that was vibrant, right? So the category was open to interpretation and change. But what I found was that in the grassroots Caribbean context and in the grassroots African diaspora context, because I thought this was also true in the U.S., when people in the grassroots, you know, I used a quote that Henry put onto the poster, a quote that I like from Hurston, Zora Neale Hurston, where there's a quote that she made, not in a particular essay, but Valerie Boyd, who did a recent biography of her, sort of collected a lot of her sayings, and she said, "The man in the gutter is the God maker. He's the creator of everything that lasts." And so back to what I'm saying about culture, one of the things I discovered is that when you look at the grassroots context, when people coming from that grassroots black place use the word culture, it was supposed to be something positive, right? Culture was the thing that kept you alive, right? If it was killing you, that was something else, right? They weren't going to use that term to describe the thing that took you out, right? So I throw that out there. So I fairly recently, funnily enough, I read Baraka's essay, The Changing Same. I was familiar with his work, and I was familiar with the fact that he had written an essay called The Changing Same, but for a long time I hadn't read it. And as I began to continue the research that I'm doing currently towards another project, I got really interested in the idea, right? And so I said, let me check out this essay. On the surface, his essay, written in 1966 during what people refer to as his Black Nationalist period, is about what I would call, this is my summary version, the sort of sacred African origins of secular Black U.S. music, with an emphasis on rhythm and blues and new jazz at the time. He covers a lot of territory in his essay, politically and theoretically. And, you know, he says some very interesting and provocative things. I was most interested in the concept and what was he doing with this concept, this thing called the changing same. I liked the fact that from my own way of seeing things, it moved me theoretically outside of a kind of either or, and even a kind of post-structuralist, neither this nor that type of split or binary. What do I mean by that? I'll say a little quick thing. Veve Clark, when she wrote her essay, Diaspora Literacy and Morassa Consciousness, one of the things she did in the essay is she had a diagram of a Haitian symbol called the Veve, right? And I won't do an excellent job of describing this, but I'll describe it as much as I can to make a point. The symbol that she had, and I wish I had a photograph, had three sections to it, right? And three sort of circular points in the middle. And then, let's say, pyramid sections going up and down. Each of the pyramid sections were different, right? But the three circular sections in the middle were the same, right? And so she used that image coming from that particular indigenous spiritual context to talk about movement that at one and the same time could maintain a sense of stability and improvise, right? So the two things can happen at once. So I felt as if Baraka, in a way, suggests a similar thing. In the essay, he made it clear to me that what black people in this hemisphere, and he's speaking specifically about the U.S., on the deepest levels, and this is something I've been thinking about for a while, this particular point I'm about to make, what they had done with Christianity, right? And I don't consider myself Christian, but what they had done with Christianity was more than Africanize it. They had reinterpreted and remade it, frequently unconsciously, for their own healing spiritual purposes. In his essay, he states, the African impulses were redistributed, and the expression itself became Christianized and post-Christianized, right? And this sort of gels with two other sets of observations from other places. Zora Neale Hurston, in an early essay that she wrote in the 20s called The Sanctified Church, where she actually was a kind of anthropologist going into sanctified churches in the South, part of which she was familiar with from growing up, but then she was also approaching it as a scholar at the time, and she said, quote, "The Negro has not been Christianized as extensively as is generally believed. The great masses are still standing before their pagan altars and calling old gods by new names, right? Unquote. In Jamaican context, the Jamaican context where I'm from, there's a scholar named Mervyn Alain who talks about an Africanized religion called Mayal, M-Y-A-L, which was as dominant in the 17th, 18th, and early 19th century Jamaican context as voodoo was thought to be in Haiti prior to the Haitian Revolution in 1804. But what happens in Jamaica is there was a rebellion in 1762 called Tacky's Rebellion. And because the enslaved Africans drew on some of that spiritual practice as a form of resistance, it was then outlawed, right? At pain of death if you were found practicing it. So it stamped it out in a certain kind of way. But what happened is, and this scholar makes note, that the African religion Mayal was easily able to adopt and be adopted by Christianity, right? So it intermingled with a form of Baptist doctrinal practice that some missionary named George Leal brought to the island, and then it bequeathed something that in the Jamaican context now is referred to as Zion Revival, which itself was a sort of Afro-Christian fusion, right, of the sort of African stuff and this Christian stuff. And what I found is that all these things are kind of on a continuum, particularly in Jamaica, right, with some spiritual practices coming straight out of the continent and remaining in certain types of forms, and others coming straight from European missionary context, and then many things being on a kind of weird mixed continuum in the middle. But anyway, this apparently influenced and gave birth to Rastafari. But I'm going to go back to Baraka. So one of the things that he does quite well in this essay, I think, is to speak about the relationship between the sacred and the secular and how it shaped African-American music at a particular moment, but that laid the foundation for many aspects of cultural expression. I'm interested in this idea that I'm using now called Afro-indigenization. There's a lot of ways to talk about what that means, but for me what it means is to Africanize or indigenize something. And I'm thinking about this as something, a kind of practice that I see coming out of the African-American context in a contemporary moment. So I describe it as this is the process by which Afro-indigenous populations, and that's both interpreted, reinterpreted, and created new cultural modes of expression, taking something old and using it to make something new while maintaining an element of the original feeling, purpose, or expression at its core. This is then used as a strategy for spiritual rejuvenation and survival. The dominant characteristic, I think, of this type of expression is characterized by this principle of the changing same, right? Baraka states in the essay, to go back in any historical or emotional line of ascent in black music leads us inevitably to, quote, religion, i.e. spirit worship, he says, right? As a demonstration of these practices, he describes the music of the 1960s jazz musician Albert Ayler. And his description of Ayler's sound can be seen as a creolization of what he calls old-timey religious tunes on one hand. On the other hand, Ayler performs a kind of indigenizing of the European saxophone when he's said to make it, quote, shout and holler in a way that resembles similar vocal expressions in the black church setting. Baraka states that Ayler transforms the saxophone into, quote, a howling spirit summoner tied around the mad black man's neck, unquote. Baraka also describes Harlem's Daddy Grace shout band of that era as a brass band with, quote, somewhat the same instrumentation as a European brass choir. But he further states, quote, at the lips of Daddy's summoners, the band is free and makes sounds to tear down the walls of anywhere. The instruments shout and holler just like folks. It is their lives being projected then, and they are different from the lives that Telemann or Vivaldi sought to reanimate with their music. And I would argue with both these examples that Baraka makes it clear that black musical forms are in some instances creolized versions of continental African forms, and in other instances they're indigenized versions of Western musical forms. So there's a lot that I could say. I could get into a lot more detail about the essay and the examples that he uses, but I'm interested in certain kinds of broad strokes because I'm hoping that I can juxtapose a variety of things which will allow us to have a useful, hopefully useful conversation in a bit. For me, one of the implications of the changing same is that the principle of the changing same demonstrates that repetition and difference can coexist, right? And this coexistence is both theory and practice, right? I'm going to show a video clip in a bit, and I hope to demonstrate with this, I hope that the clip will help to demonstrate that this is not just a sort of abstract utopian set of possibilities, but that there are practical, concrete, contemporary ways in which this functions. I also feel that the changing same is the ability to bring the unspoken into a conversation. I see it as an equalizing principle, one that can restore balance. I hesitate to use that, but balance to a kind of chaos. How shall I say, justice to unjust situations. But I'm gonna show this clip. The clip is about 15 minutes. I'm gonna set it up by telling you a little bit about the documentary that it's coming out of. I don't know if anyone has seen this. It's a documentary called Rise, R-I-Z-E. It was made about 10 years ago. Latino filmmaker, and it's about a group of young people in South Central Los Angeles, right, who are part of what I call hip-hop culture, right? And what does this mean? They're exposed to and influenced by the negative and the positive aspects of what this means. Crack, urban removal, parents who've been incarcerated, right? Horrifyingly bad urban school systems, things of that sort, right? And they're also influenced by the music, and the music, as you know, is profane. Some people like it, some people don't. Some of it is saying something provocative, some of it isn't, right? You know, all of that wild, crazy stuff. And hip-hop, I teach a course at OU, funnily enough, called Hip Hop as Poetry, Literature, and Cultural Expression, because I'm sort of on the older edge of exposure and influence, you know, being influenced by the music. And why did I mention that? I mentioned that for a reason. But it was something about the business of it all being so profane and difficult.
The changing same, notion of the changing same, right?
I'll come in a way, but I think that Rise, this documentary. So the young people in it, I know why I mentioned it. They say that there are five elements of hip hop for those people who, the foundational crew of artists and creators, and they talk about hip hop as having the DJ, right? Who is, back in the day, scratching and mixing the records. The MC, right, who's rhyming over the beats. The breakdancers, who are actually dancing in the breaks that's happening in the music. The graffiti artists, right, who are saying whatever they want to say, but the forms of the graffiti artwork was actually imitating the movement of the breakdancers, right, who are stylizing at all. And then the fifth element was self-knowledge, knowledge of self, right? I lay that out there because the young people in this are very much influenced by that. but trapped, right? Trapped in a moment where they feel that there's not much they can do. So I think in a way it speaks for itself. So what they do is they come up with this style of dancing that they call crumping, right? Which emerges from something that was called clowning, that was created by this guy named Tommy the Clown, right? And Tommy was a young man in South Central Los Angeles who went to prison, came out, decided he wanted to do something different, and was invited by a young woman to a party where he was asked to dress up as a dancing clown, and then he suddenly found that, oh, wait, you know, I can do something with this. But it became something much larger than that. So the Crumpers break off from the clown groups and do this other thing, right? So I want to show this clip. It's about 14 minutes, and after we watch it, there's some things I want to say which ultimately I feel tie back to the concepts that I've hopefully been trying to lay out in terms of the changing same. And then I hope that we can have a conversation about this. And at the very end, I'm hoping to share a poem of my own. My poem is called Congo, and I just wanted to tell you briefly a little bit about the context of my writing it, and there's a couple of, strangely enough, footnotes, which I want to explain so that even if you don't remember them, when you hear it through the poem, maybe you will retain some of it. I wrote it after reading two books. One is King Leopold's Ghost. Anyone familiar with that? Which was a fantastic, I thought, reporting by a journalist, I forget his name now, on the whole business of the trauma that the Congolese went through as a result of the desire to take rubber from the country, right, and how much it deeply affected the population. And I was reading that alongside a book called Central Africa and the Caribbean, which was talking about the extent to which Central Africa, not just West Africa, had influenced and shaped a lot of Caribbean populations, and that some of those traditions were there. I was very upset, and I wrote this about 7 years ago. And so some references in there. One is Kunu spirits, which is a belief of the Suriname Maroons that the avenging spirits of people or gods who were wronged during their lifetime, and who pledged themselves to tormenting eternally the matrilineal descendants of the close matrilineal kin of the offender. Right. Makandal, He was a first century Maroon leader on the southeast border of Haiti and Santo Domingo. And Makaya was an enslaved African in northern Haiti who had a big knowledge of poison and magic packets, who died by execution in 1758. Lemba was a rebel leader, also from the Haitian context. And the last little reference I have here is Mamba Malaka. It's a Congo name for a newborn child who's coming into a world where many problems will face him or her. And then die like Kalunga, which means to die a violent death. Okay, Congo, Kaongo. I came back to bury my dead and found that the light night had passed into a saturated darkness. Deep whisper in the eaves. Congo River, red and wide. Tell me what ground the blood of my people has sanctified. I came back across the water, traveling night and day through sea and surf. I slept in the cold, deep underbelly of the ocean, no light for miles, carried by current through storm and undulation. When we were sold to the white men, we walked for days out and through forest to the wide open water. The iron cut deep into my neck flesh. My core split open, and I lost consciousness. Hear me. My people killed with the shikot and the bullets on the bloodthirsty quest for rubber at the heart of the crossroads of our continent of rivers. Kunu spirits, rise up. May your severed hands appear in the dreams of the benefiting descendants of those who murdered you, burnt your villages, and gave the orders for your savage annihilation. Kebinda, Makandal, Makaya, and Lemba, ancient warriors of the First Order, is it possible that the ship, weighted down in the bowels of necromancy and darkness, bore us to a fate better than our kin across the water, sacrificed for the ivory, rubber, and ore necessary to make their weapons of mass destruction? Dambala and Ida Wado, tell them never to speak to us again about the Holocaust unless they reference the tens of millions slaughtered in the Congo or the First World weapons funding genocide between brethren in Rwanda and Uganda, or the fight for our minerals, fueling their vapid materialistic hunger, the body count in Southern Africa that has financed diamond engagement rings all over the world. Spirit of the dead in Congo, heart of earth, birth of life, twa hunter-gatherers, my people of the earliest civilizations, the corrupt seed has splintered to the four corners in four directions, carried by a foul wind. Is the source of this vacuum in conscience a vacuum in spirit? Mamba Malaka, you are the fruit of the future world, with a weight wrought in iron blowing down on your shoulders. To you falls the task of creation, seasoning this cyclonic blue hole with the ripples of foam you have to divine yourselves. I've come back across the sea to find that here, as there, my people die like Kalunga. Message gatherer, spread your message, spread your wisdom to the unbelonging, entombed in the rows of bars, waiting for death in blue overalls, sorted and shackled, tracked and caged by the descendants of the men who profited from the enslavement of your ancestors. My hunted brethren, practice the capoeira physics, the Rastafari rebel yell, the Ifa divination, the sonic jihad, the revolutionary crossing of Jordan over to Zion, the body-breaking boundaries bequeathed to you from a prism of people who have survived seismic shifts and cybernetic genocide, disregarded, left for dead, dehumanized. Hope bringer, High John the Conqueror, the eagle squints, the vulture hovers. The trees have been our witness. Teach us how to read again in the language of the hushed ones who soar and leap and have breathed upright for years, rooted in the rock face of precipice seen by no mortal. Teach us again the things we may have known, that their literal eye decried as stagnant mythology, while they smashed their own world into splintered remnants of forgotten sounds, chasing ghosts created in the wake of their primal terror, of their being nothing, being and nothingness, zombie dream of civilization, Frankenstein science of atom-splitting proportions, mushrooming out and up and in, victims of a nightmare disguised as a morphine-induced and bejeweled ride through thirsty desire without solace or symptom, a face without a head. We, the bend-down lowers, will look with eyes focused through time and see our formation as it was. We come from the beam rays and the smoldering rock, the sandy underbelly and the fluid abyss, the far-flung corners of the creation void, of shifting patterns of lights where power rises from the hearse of the flesh, laying fields of energy thick with the treason of our decay, fertilizing the fruit born from the blood-soaked earth, bequeathing to us the secrets of the vital sap, the proverbial mustard seed as a portal to God. I came back to bury my dead and found that the light night had passed into a saturated darkness. Deep whisper in the eaves, Congo River red and wide. Tell me what ground the blood of my people has sanctified. Congo, heart of darkness, heart of light. They have failed, and they know, but they still believe us savages. My brethren in conflict, killing your kin and kind, in plunder and disarray, fueled by your hunger for the land that belonged to your forebears, and the bread to feed your children, and the right to teach them what you once knew about how to live. My brethren in arms, fighting a fight begun by their bottomless thirst for more, you once knew better. Your sister made the call before her death when we left our dead behind us. The time has finally come for you, for us. Know what you know.
Thank you.